Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Taking Liberties, the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. My name is Emily Morrow.
And I'm Jared Odesky.
Today, we are very lucky to be speaking with James Essex, who is the director of the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, James.
Great to be here.
On today's episode, we will be speaking about three major LGBTQ rights cases that are currently before the Supreme Court. For our listeners who are not aware, those three cases are Bostock versus Clayton County, Altitude Express versus Zarda, and RG and GR Harris Funeral Homes versus EEOC. The issue before the court is whether Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits employment discrimination because of sex, includes a prohibition on discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. So to start, James, would you be able to tell us a little bit more about the facts of these cases and your role in this litigation?
Sure thing. Again, I'm super happy to be with you folks talking about this stuff. And I just wanted to say that, like, I think 30 years ago this fall, I was a 1L and started doing work with CRCL, and I ended up being on the staff later in my law school career. So it's wonderful to connect back up with CRCL here. In the cases, the cases that you actually want to talk about, the ACLU is counsel for the employees in two of the three cases that you mentioned, in the Zarda case and in the Harris Funeral Homes case, which is about a woman named Amy Stevens. And we worked with counsel in the Bostock case as it was briefed and they were argued together. So the facts are pretty straightforward in all three cases. In the Harris Funeral Homes case, Harris Funeral Homes versus EEOC, a woman named Amy Stevens worked as a funeral director for a funeral home just outside of Detroit for about 6 years. And her employer and work colleagues knew her as a guy, but she had known since she was a kid that she's a woman. And she had been hiding that all of her life, and finally gathered the courage to come out to her coworkers and her employer as a woman. And in response to that, she gets fired very specifically because she's trans. In the Zarda case, Altitude Express versus Zarda, it involves a guy named Don Zarda, who was a skydiving aficionado and kind of addict. And he became a skydiving instructor at a skydiving place on Long Island in New York State. And when he came out to a customer during a skydive, where he was teaching this person to skydive, and she complained to management about that, and he gets fired for sharing inappropriate information with a customer. And in Bostock versus Clayton County, involved a man named Gerald Bostock, who worked for Clayton County, Georgia, as a CASA, court-appointed special advocate coordinator in the juvenile courts. And so but his job was to oversee these advocates in the court system who help kids who are in the juvenile justice system to try and give them an ally as they go through the criminal justice system. And his job was to supervise them and to recruit new people to come into that role. And so he joined a gay softball league in Atlanta, and he was recruiting people for this CASA program through his gay softball league. And that got to the attention of managers, and he gets fired. So all three of them sue in federal court, saying that they're firing because they're gay or transgender violates Title VII under a theory that anti-LGBT discrimination is a form of sex discrimination.
Thank you for that really helpful background, James. And I think to get straight to that argument, it seems that, in the briefs and in oral argument, the court focused on the text of the statute, the argument being that the words because of sex include discrimination based on sexual orientation and transgender status as a subset of sex discrimination. And that seems to have convinced both conservative textualists and liberals in lower courts of appeal. Could you walk us through your primary textual argument here and how you think the justices responded?
Sure. So as you said, the big picture is you know, whether anti-LGBT discrimination is a form of sex discrimination, because Title VII bars sex discrimination but doesn't specifically mention sexual orientation or gender identity. And so one way to look at this would be to say that the term sex in Title VII should be understood to encompass gender identity and sexual orientation. And I think that's correct, and I think it should be a winner, but it's not clear that that argument would work for the conservatives and the textualists on the court, because the concern is that, you know, it seems like we're trying to update the meaning of sex to a definition that the 1964 Congress that passed Title VII wouldn't have agreed with. So another way to approach the analysis is to say that even if we just assume that the term sex in Title VII means sex assigned at birth and nothing else, that the anti-LGBT discrimination is still because of sex, and because of sex being the operative term in Title VII, it says, okay, if the firing is because of sex, that violates the statute. So think about this argument that sex equals at least, at a minimum, sex assigned at birth in the context of the cases. So take Amy Stevens, the transgender case. Amy is a transgender woman, which means that she lives and identifies as a woman, even though she was assigned male at birth. And if she's fired because she's a transgender woman, it's true that if she were a woman who were assigned female at birth instead of a woman who was assigned male at birth, she wouldn't have been fired. So that means that she was fired because she was assigned male at birth. She was fired because of her sex. And that gets us to a ruling and a recognition that anti-trans discrimination is a form of sex discrimination without having to say, you know, we're updating what the term sex means, because the term sex in this context, all it means and all it has to mean is sex assigned at birth. You can do the same thing with Don Zarda's case, the skydiver. Don was a man attracted to men. If he had been a woman attracted to men, he would not have been fired. So he's fired because he's a man, and that's sex discrimination, again, even using a narrow definition of sex. And so what's different about this analysis is that there's no updating of the definition of sex that's needed in order for the employees to win. Again, I think the, you know, the argument that sex includes gender identity and sexual orientation, I totally think that's right. I think it should be a winner. This other argument is something that could well convince some of the justices, because I think that we are, you know, likely to need this kind of an analysis in order to win in all three cases.
Great. Yeah, and we were just talking about this, but I think it would be helpful to spend just a little bit more time on the dynamics around the interpretive methodology a little bit, if we could, because you know, typically we would see more of the liberal justices focusing on the purpose of a piece of legislation or its legislative history, but it was not really. That was not really the case here. You know, I think in oral arguments, even Justice Kagan had dismissed some of the points that were made in oral argument that were made by the Solicitor General about the subsequent legislative history or lack thereof in this case. Could you talk about, you know, your sense of how the legislative history piece was dealt with at oral argument?
Sure. Interesting question. I think that you're right that here we had a situation where the employees who were, you know, arguing for coverage for LGBTQ people were using textualist arguments while the government was arguing against coverage using legislative history and purpose arguments. So the government saying to people, to the court, they're saying, look, Congress wasn't thinking about LGBTQ people in 1964 when it passed Title VII, and that's probably right, but that's an argument about what was Congress's purpose, what does the legislative history show, was there any mention of LGBTQ people in the debates in Congress when they added sex? And the answer to that is, like, no, there's nothing about LGBTQ people, but there was no legislative history and debates about adding sex. It was just added with no discussion. But so there you have the government arguing legislative history and purpose, and in contrast, the employees were arguing, hey, the what Congress thought in 1964 doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is the text. Now, the employees have as as an ally in that argument, Justice Scalia, because he's been when he was alive, was the primary proponent of this textualist approach. The employees and we, as the lawyers for the employees, pointed to a Justice Scalia decision from 1998 in a case called Oncal versus Sundowner Offshore Oil Services. And it was a case, a Title VII case, about whether same-sex sexual harassment was a form of sex discrimination under Title VII. And the lower federal courts had been all over the place on this question. And there was a period of time in the mid-90s when, there were decisions from district courts and from circuit courts coming out every month or so, going different ways. And so the issue gets to the Supreme Court. And Justice Scalia writes an opinion for a unanimous court saying, well, look, this guy gets harassed because he's a guy, and that is sex discrimination that violates Title VII, and this isn't hard. And it says, it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't matter what Congress was thinking about in 1964. What matters is what are the words that Congress enacted, and what do those words mean. You're right that what many people may think of as the normal positions, the expected positions in terms of who's arguing which kind of statutory interpretation model is flipped here a little bit. I will say that you mentioned, I think, subsequent legislative history, and that is something that it does not have a good pedigree in terms of, if what you're saying is like if a law is passed in 1964 you're trying to figure out from laws that were either passed or not passed later on, years later, by different Congresses, how much does that mean about what the Congress in 1964 was thinking? So you're right, I think Justice Kagan was not having that argument, but I think others, I don't think that argument is going to work for them. At least I'm hoping it doesn't.
Right. Well, so speaking of committed textualists, we had Justice Gorsuch at oral argument, somewhat seeming persuaded by these textual arguments. But in the Harris case, he expressed this concern that, sort of out of left field about massive social upheaval when, speaking of flip narratives, usually it's, progressives trying to bring in sort of social context into the picture. So what is your reaction to that statement from him?
Three different points to come to mind for me. I mean, the first is, I think, where you were starting, which is, like, look for a committed textualist like Justice Gorsuch. You would think that the rule would be like, okay, the text leads wherever it leads. And, if there are, social consequences, that's something that Congress can deal with and Congress can fix because the court is simply, following the text of the statute that Congress passed. So I was, you said it came out of left field. I think I had the same kind of reaction, like, okay, why is this on the table? But assume it is on the table, it's clearly on his mind. My second reaction is that, look, there has been already no massive social upheaval from recognizing that trans folks are protected from arbitrary job discrimination because the federal appeals courts, going back 20 years to two decisions in 2000, have said that anti-trans discrimination is a form of sex discrimination that violates a whole range of federal civil rights acts. Not just Title VII, but Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Gender Motivated Violence Act. There are all these federal statutes that bar sex discrimination that have been interpreted to cover trans people. And, that reality of having those protections has not caused massive disruption, hasn't caused problems with restrooms, hasn't caused anything. you know, I think my colleague David Cole, who argued for Amy Stevens, said during the argument that, like, hey, there are trans lawyers in this courtroom now, and they are following the dress code, which is a gendered dress code for the bar section of the court, and they are using the restrooms, and they're gendered restrooms, and, you know, there's no problem. So the second point is, like, there's no massive social upheaval. But the third point, and this came from a colleague of mine here at the ACLU, Rio Moore, said, look, you know, civil rights laws were passed to create upheaval. Civil rights laws were passed to change the way we operate as a society. And so, you know, social upheaval, even if you think that's what's going to happen, that's not a, you know, an inappropriate byproduct of a civil rights law. That's the expected, intended, appropriate byproduct of a civil rights law. That is changing the way we operate as a society. So that shouldn't have been a problem on multiple levels.
And that's a really interesting point. Just going back to the second point that you were making in your response just then, I mean, one of the things that was particularly troubling about Justice Gorsuch's statement is that it really seemed to mischaracterize the reality. And I'm just curious if how you as a litigator deal with those kinds of distortions of fact when you're litigating a case.
It's hard. It's hard. Certainly, in the context of an oral argument like this with the Supreme Court, it's, you know, David could and did point to the case law that's out there. Sometimes you have a record that you have created that may make a difference. And so in this case, we at the ACLU, we were not counsel in the trial court. It was the EEOC to put the case together, and so we did not have control over the record here that might have helped out some. But there are a bunch of cases where we have been able to develop facts that we know are going to make a difference to both the trial judge and to the judges on the courts of appeals and on the Supreme Court if the case gets there. So in a range of cases that we've litigated in the past about around attacking states' bans on adoption or foster parenting by LGBTQ people, we developed records, a record about facts about children being raised by lesbian, gay, and bisexual parents, because that was something that there's actually a lot of social science about, and there's no reason that the judges would know it. And that was something that could and did, in fact, give judges comfort and knowledge. And in the same way, in a series of cases around freedom to marry for same-sex couples, we developed a similar record, again, about kids being raised by lesbian, gay, and bisexual parents, because the opponents of marriage equality were relying for such a long time so heavily on the idea that gay people getting married would be bad for kids. And so we needed to put some facts in front of them. In some cases about transgender people, we have also developed similar records about the science, the reality of who transgender people are and what medical care is, you know, is needed for many people. And that's one way to try and address the kind of mischaracterization of reality, as you mentioned, as we go through the process of litigating a case.
That's really helpful, especially for budding lawyers who I know are listening as they're thinking through their future lives as litigators. So just to shift gears a little bit, I think going into oral argument, there was a big fear, and I know this was in headlines when cert was granted back in the spring, that Price Waterhouse, the concept of sex stereotyping itself, was under threat from the Supreme Court taking a look at these cases. Do you think coming out of oral argument that fear has been assuaged at all?
Yeah, so look, I don't think we're out of the woods here. I mean, look, I come out of oral arguments thinking that this is a case that could still go either way. Meaning a win for the employees or a loss. a loss could undermine Pricewaterhouse in a serious way. So the Pricewaterhouse Supreme Court case from 1989 is something that recognizes for the first time that sex stereotyping, enforcing an employer's stereotypes on its employees, is or can be a kind of sex discrimination. And the argument here for all three employees is, hey, you know, these employers are enforcing the employer's stereotypes about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, on Amy, Don, and Gerald, the three employees here. And the concern is that if the court is rules for the employers, and, you know, like, how is it going to get around the sex stereotyping argument here? They could just, you know, do something that says, well, we're just going to carve LGBTQ people out. And they could do that, and courts have done that before. But there's no principled way to do that, or at least I don't see a principled way to do that. And that's the thing that leads to the fear that not only would a loss here mean that LGBTQ people would not be able to bring a sex stereotyping-based sex discrimination claim based on Pricewaterhouse, but that nobody would be able to, because the court would say, would call into question or just outright overrule Pricewaterhouse on that point. At oral argument, there was nothing said that makes me worried about that. But there was nothing said that makes me not worried about that either. So I think this is still a possibility in terms of the range of scenarios that could come in a decision.
Right. So another thing that was noted by commentators coming out of oral argument and as these cases have been making their way up to the court is that the plaintiffs in these three cases are two gay men and a transgender woman. You know, the LGBTQ community is obviously a very broad community, and not everyone fits into sort of these LG, B, and T markers. How do you think the plaintiffs' arguments work for, you know, others in the community, like gender nonconforming people, intersex people, and others that fall within the spectrum?
Mm-hmm. So I think the argument is basically the same. Like, if a man is fired for being bisexual, he's fired because he's not exclusively attracted to women, as all men are supposed to be. And I think that's the same sex discrimination claim that Don Zarda has. Don Zarda's fired because he's supposed to be exclusively attracted to women, and he's not. And I think the same thing would be true for a person who's bisexual. And I think basically the same thing works on the non-binary side of things as well. So that I think that these arguments would work for the full spectrum of LGBTQ people. You know, the first question is, okay, so how are these cases going to come out? And that's, you know, that's not clear. And we definitely want to litigate these cases in a way that, you know, does no damage to anybody else's claims down the road. But although those claims down the road also, you know, are not likely to go anywhere if we lose these cases. So, you know, the sometimes challenging and frustrating, you know, situation of incrementalism in, you know, the reality of civil rights litigation is that you need to focus on, you know, trying to get the votes for the case that you have in front of the court. But again, I don't think that there's tension between the arguments that we made for these plaintiffs and a broader range of LGBTQ folks.
Great. So just to wrap up, we have two final questions for you. So the cases we've been talking about today are clearly LGBTQ rights cases, but they're also about workers' rights more generally. And I'm curious how you, if at all, see this fight as fitting into a larger struggle for broader workplace protections more generally.
Well, I do think it's part of a broader struggle for workers' rights, but I think that we're, you know, we're stuck in a particular model. That is, I think that most workplace rights in America are based on a discrimination model. statutes that say employers can't discriminate based on X, Y, and Z factors. In some limited contexts, there are broader protections for workers, as you, of course, know, like in unions and government civil service rules and stuff like that. But those are contexts that are, shrinking, at least the unionized portion of the workforce is shrinking every year. And, you know, these cases help fill out the discrimination model, but they don't address the larger question of giving workers more leverage and more protection from unfair firings, generally that aren't about discrimination. And there's, you know, there are other models out there across the world in terms of giving greater protection from being fired under other systems, and that is, you know, at the moment, so not the workplace rules world that we all live in here.
Mm-hmm.
And these cases are not going to change that in a big way. They're just, I hope, going to mean that the existing protections for workers in this country under federal law, you know, are clarified to cover LGBTQ folks.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now that oral arguments are over, what are the next steps for the ACLU here, and what can our listeners be doing to support this effort, as I know they would like to do?
Sure. Well, so look, let me put these cases in context a little bit to talk about next steps. So the LGBTQ advocacy community has been trying to get basic non-discrimination protections in employment, housing, public accommodations, education, et cetera, for decades. And we've been trying to do that through two different avenues. One is passing through Congress express protections for LGBTQ people through the Civil Rights Act. And that, there was a bill called, I think called the Equality Act back in 1973 that would have added sexual orientation to the Civil Rights Act. And there's a bill pending in Congress right now called, still, the Equality Act that would add LGBTQ folks expressly as part of sex discrimination and actually do some other things as well. And that bill passed the House of Representatives this spring, and we're waiting to see if it gets taken up in the Senate. Chances are very high that it won't be, given leadership's priorities. But these cases that we've been talking about are obviously the sort of culmination, the end game, of a separate parallel strategy of getting the courts and administrative agencies in the federal government, like the EEOC, to agree that the existing ban on sex discrimination covers LGBTQ people. We are at a place where we could be close to endgame in both the litigation strategy and the legislative strategy if the cases come out well and if Congress or a new Congress after next year's elections actually moves on the Equality Act. What people can do is push for the Equality Act. Call your senator, especially, and also help us make the Equality Act and LGBTQ equality more generally an issue in the upcoming elections, in the 2020 elections for Senate especially and for president. Because even in a world in which the employees in these cases win, we are still going to need the Equality Act because, as I said, there are pieces of the Federal Civil Rights Act that have big holes in them. So there are big gaps in the Federal Civil Rights Act. And if we win these cases under Title VII, that means or should mean that LGBTQ people are protected under Title VII, but also under every other federal civil rights law that bars sex discrimination. And the problem is that there are big parts of the federal civil rights regime that don't cover sex. So the federal ban on discrimination by places of public accommodation doesn't bar sex discrimination. And so winning these cases doesn't get LGBTQ people protection in the context of public accommodations because there's no sex-based protection. That's an astounding gap, an egregious gap in the Civil Rights Act that should have been filled a long time ago. And we need to fill that now, and we need to fill that even if we win these cases. There's also a piece of the Federal Civil Rights Act that bars discrimination by recipients of federal grants, federal funds. And that also doesn't bar sex discrimination, and that gap should be filled as well. So we need to pass the Equality Act, whether we win these cases or lose these cases. And that's one thing that people can do.
It's a great call to action. Thank you so much again, James, for taking the time today. I think this was illuminating for us and hopefully illuminating for our listeners, and we appreciate all of your insight.
Great. Thank you very much.